Welcome to the Humanity Matters podcast, where we discuss and reflect on faith and philosophy, leadership and social issues. We want to engage in ideas and what it means to be a free human being in the pursuit of human flourishing. For more information, please visit our website, philipfletcher.org. And now, the Humanity Matters podcast.
As we're having this conversation, and feel free to ask me some questions if you have any about that process, but we'll be talking about that too with Dr. Fletcher, so I'm going to ask him to join me up here and sort of give us an introduction. I have some questions that we're going to go off of as long as it takes to get through these. But like I said, it's all pretty informal, so feel free to jump in, raise your hand, I guess, or say something. Either way, as long as two people don't say something at the same time. So our first question is, everybody starts every company for a different reason. Some of them have a passion for things, or some of them just see a need, that there's something out there that needs to be done, and so they form a company. And nonprofits are the same way. So I'm going to ask Dr. Fletcher to tell us about his personal motivation and driving force behind starting his nonprofit, and just tell us, introduce yourself.
Yeah, good. It's good to be here. So my nonprofit is the City of Hope Outreach, and located in Conway, Arkansas, just a little 30 minutes from here, in central Arkansas. And my motivation, well, we deal, I moved here back in 2007 out of the military. And just got back from Iraq, OIF-3, and so moved here to finish some military training and ended up staying here. Got a job actually across the street at the county courthouse, and I ran voter registration for all of Pulaski County.
Nice.
So while I was doing that, went home from work one day, leaving here, and just got inspired to make a right on the street called Robbins. And back there is this trailer park. And unknown to me at the time, and later to find out, it was probably the worst area in Conway in terms of crime, drug use, prostitution, domestic abuse, you name it. The police were pretty much out there every day, morning, noon, and night, for some type of difficulty within the human experience. And so myself and my family, the five of us, we went out there, we didn't have anything except some sound equipment, a PV sound system, and some folding chairs, and we just started loving on the people out there. And so this was in 2007, so from 2007 to 2009, we were just seeking to serve people, understanding what their needs were. We have three colleges in Conway, so UCA, CBC, Central Baptist College, and Hendricks College. So we would reach out to all these college students, like, hey, we're doing this thing out here in the trailer park. You want to help out? Come. People would come. And we did all types of things. And then my mentor, Mark Snar, he was the vice president for Heifer International into the street here. And he and his wife came and saw what we were doing. And he was like, hey, you ever thought about starting a nonprofit? And at that point, my only familiarity with a nonprofit was my fraternity that I pledged in college, and I volunteered at the Urban League and got a job there. So that was my framework for a nonprofit. Even then, you know, it was like parties, college life. I'm helping kids after school. So all the other stuff, the legal stuff and strategic stuff and all that, I really didn't have a framework for, and everything I understood was military life. And I said, well, what do I gotta do, you know? So me and Mark, this is one of the things we'll get to, is we would meet every Friday at a restaurant called Stogie's, like 6:30 in the morning. And he essentially just opened my brain and poured in everything about nonprofits every Friday for like 2.5 years into my head. And so we organized, got a board of directors, 20 individuals who got it started, did all the bylaws and all all that kind of stuff. And came, got our determination letter in 2009. Yeah, 2009, October. 2009, we got our determination letter, became a nonprofit 501c3. That way we started applying for grants and all of that good stuff. And essentially our focus is motivated by the fundamental belief that every human being, regardless of where they come from, how they vote, who they love, who they live with, where they live, how much they make or don't make, is made in the image and likeness of God. Everybody has human dignity, and we leverage that in the belief that whatever that you have as an individual and as a family, what are your goals? How is it that you want to flourish as a human being? And so in three strategic ways, it's education, housing, and nutrition is what we focus on as a community development organization now. And how that works out on an everyday basis is we have an after school program for kids that meets Monday through Friday. And that's on the education, and we're about to start an adult portion of that. For our housing, we've got a home for men, and then we're finishing up building our first tiny home project called Hope Village, and it's 10 small homes, 5 one-bedroom, 5 two-bedroom homes. So that'll be done this year. So that's phase one of what we're doing. And then the third portion is nutrition, and so we've got a market that we have where people can come and shop and get volunteer experience and work experience. And then we do urban gardening. So we have one big garden on our main campus, and then we have a partnership with a church in Conway with another huge garden as well. And that produces produce, educational lab, if you will, for individuals to come and learn how to create their own small plot of gardening and produce and healthy food. And then we work with other nonprofits, specifically around homelessness and poverty issues. So we have a homeless coalition that meets once a month. So, yeah, I am motivated by what I believe to be the truth is that everybody is unique, remarkable, and unrepeatable. And I want that to shine. So.
Well, that sounds like quite a story. Sounds like you have a massive nonprofit. A lot of stuff going on, good
yeah.
stuff. And
yeah.
our next question is going to be about daunting tasks. And I think he has a lot of them. I'm going to tell you some things I see from an attorney's point of view that clients seem to have as daunting tasks. So to form a nonprofit and to register with the Arkansas Secretary of State, the name of your company, your nonprofit, has to be kind of unique and nobody else has it. And if somebody else already has it, the Secretary of State won't let you have it. They'll make you make some kind of changes. But also you have to have a board of directors, which he mentioned, and he said they have 20, which is large, but the Secretary of State requires 3. So to make that filing, you have to have at least 3 people that are willing to be on your board of directors. It can be you in addition to 2 other people. And I sometimes offer that service to my clients if they're just getting started. You know, I can be on your board until you get more people. Now, some people have nonprofits that they want to start and they have a big framework already set out. But in this case, I'm talking about people who are just like, I'm just wanting to get this thing started. So that would be your first step, would be to form with the company, with the Secretary of State, have those 3 directors. And then he also talked about his determination letter. So there's 2 kinds of nonprofits that you can form. One is a 501c4, and one is a 501c3. And the 501c3, which is mostly what we're going to be talking about here, gives you exempt status, so if people donate, make donations to you, they can call those tax exempt. And those can't be political or anything like that. They can't have a political, they can be for reasons of education or promoting a better quality of life or whatever. There's also a 501c4, and those can be political, especially in the sense of, so one of my clients is the League of Women Voters in Arkansas, not U.S., but and specifically in Washington County. I'm from, you know, Northwest Arkansas, Washington County. And they have two arms. One is their 501c4, and one is their 501c3. And their C3 can take in money and be tax exempt, and it's for educational kind of purposes. Whereas the 501c4 is more to promote, not political in the sense of Democrats or Republicans, but political in the sense of voting rights, democracy. But they're out there pushing ballot initiatives that right now there's one for to broaden the Freedom of Information Act in Arkansas, which in our last legislative session they narrowed to make that broader again. So the League of Women Voters believe in that, and they would be, you know, trying to get education out, and maybe they file lawsuits and things like that. They couldn't get involved in, it is nonpartisan, so they couldn't get involved in other things, but they wouldn't get 501c3 status because of some of the political things that they do. And in getting your 501c3 status, I would say if that's you know, one of your goals, which most nonprofits are, to file as soon as you form your company, because you have no financial records at that point. And it's pretty much a snap to get it. I also get clients that have been in business for a while and they don't qualify for 501c3 at that point. And so then you have to show like 3 years of records and all your finances and everything else. And so the IRS is gonna go through that and look at that and see where you're spending money and who you're taking in money from and things like that. So I would just say if that's what you wanna do, form your company, get things going, and then before too long, you get into that, file for 501c3 status so you don't have those problems. And then, so those are daunting tasks from my point of view for clients, what they tell me. And then there's a yearly filing with the Secretary of State that you have to do. There's a filing with the IRS, just like we pay personal taxes and file for our personal taxes. Companies have to file taxes, and nonprofits have to file taxes with the IRS. And you make a filing with the state as well. And then it depends on how much, you know, you're taking in, how much your revenues are. If they're very small, they make it a pretty easy filing, kind of like, you know, your EZ, 1040 EZ. And the as you get bigger, the filings with the IRS are more complicated because they want to see, you know, they just want to make sure the money's coming from the right place and it's going out to the right place, that you're spending on the right things. So those are the kind of things I would say are daunting tasks in getting started and in keeping your 501c or your nonprofit going. But let's get the opinion of someone who's running a nonprofit.
So lessons learned, and one of the things I tell people that want to start a nonprofit and talk to me is find you a lawyer, and then find you an accountant. Someone that is who's worked with nonprofits before, especially when it comes to the filing of the 990, and that's due in May, traditionally to the IRS. So if you think personal, April 15th, you got a nonprofit, it's due in May, but you can file an extension. If you can find you an accountant who's familiar with completing the 990, that will be helpful as well, because if you miss filing a 990, then you can have your status put in a revocation status, and you got to go through a reapplication, kind of get it live again, as I like to say.
Yeah, so if you miss three years in a row, yeah, the IRS automatically revokes it.
Yeah.
Like you said, you can get that changed, mm-hmm, but a lot of people, those kind of filings, especially for someone who's not thinking about these kind of things, which is exactly why my office will send out reminders. Hey, this is coming up. If you need help, let me know. But you know, if you don't get back to me, then I just assume that you're doing it on your own, you're taking care of it, we've reminded you of it. But that's a good point.
Yeah. So to find somebody in your beginning stages, you've got the minimum three. right? And we can find a lawyer, retired or not, an accountant type, retired or not, who can also assist you, especially they'll do it pro bono for you. That can go a long way because that's other things you do have to worry about. I think many people that I've met, you know, they have a heart to do something, right? They want to help somebody, they want to change something that's going on in their community. And sometimes what is lost is all the legal stuff that has to happen as well so you can continue to do that in a more effective way. And so if you know people like that, you know, reach out to them and say, hey, you know, this is my idea, this is what I want to do. Could I get your assistance in, you know, doing, you know, looking over the legal stuff or as well the financial stuff. That can go a long way. The other thing is the construction of the bylaws and how your organization is going to function, all right? Because that, from my years of understanding, that's what I submit to. I got my board of directors, and we got these bylaws that have been developed and how the organization, including the policies and procedures, that's how it's gonna function. In my very beginning, I was like, I got all this information coming from Mr. Schnarr. I'm trying to figure out how all of this stuff works together. Sometimes it'll be falling on your face, but if you also lean on those quote unquote subject matter experts, they can help you figure out a lot of that stuff. Because if you get larger, then you're gonna run into things like, you have employees. Now this is no difference between business and for-profit. You still fall under all of the same labor laws and things like that. I still have to pay workers' comp insurance. I still have to pay pay taxes and all that kind of stuff as it relates to the employees, my employer liability, all those types of things, HR type things, all of those things still matter. And you know, there's organizations out there that can help you figure those things out. Or, you know, you find somebody that can sit on your board or part of a committee that can help guide you through those particular things. I think the other thing you have to do is get insurance. General liability insurance is, because that protects you if anything were to happen at your organization or some activity that your organization is conducting at that moment. So getting that in place as well.
So do you think that getting volunteers to help you has been a problem? Because I know that some of the nonprofits that I work with do have that problem.
Yeah, so one of the things that's helpful is understand where you're at. Your nonprofit's located, all right? Obviously, what is it that your nonprofit does? And then where you're at. And then looking at the landscape of where you're at and understanding who are those people that are existing in my area, right, who would respond to this type of work, okay? For instance, I'm gonna move outside of my organization. Like we have a nonprofit, they love animals, right? Now, not everybody loves animals, right? So you gotta understand then, okay, where do I go to get those type of volunteers, right? Where do I need to advertise? What events do I need to go to, right? In order to get those type of volunteers who enjoy spending time with animals, who wanna see the welfare of animals continue to increase, and then leverage my energy there. I don't need to go to a sporting event. I'm trying to go to all these different animal events to find these other different types of volunteers, right? Again, if you exist in a town that's got a college, right, then you gotta spend your time there at the college or university setting and reach out to professors, adjunct professors, and say, hey, can I come into your class, you know, share a couple of minutes with what my nonprofit does. You may get one or two, and that's the opportunity for you to get those interns and those consistent volunteers. Obviously, those fairs that happen on colleges and universities, you know, and having a table up. All you got is a Walmart, $15 Walmart table, and you printed off some material from you know, the local printer shop, and you set up with a poster board and say, this is my nonprofit looking for volunteers, then that's how you just gotta start, right? You might not have the money to send Vistaprint $1,000 to get all that, as I call, sexy stuff. Just start small, right? And then build from there, and you'll get and you'll find those individuals who align with the vision, the mission, and the goals of your nonprofit. But again, it's not gonna be everybody. So I'd rather you have three good volunteers who are all in instead of you have 100 and they're like, well, we're just here to get some hours, right? There's a difference there, you know? And so being able to get those volunteers, obviously using social media, going on different, you know, groups and pages that again have similar interests like your organization, right? Nonprofit wise, but also business wise as well. You know, I go back to the animal example. So I'm going to Petco and all these other type of animal type businesses and reaching out to them. You know, they may be a animal business that has a nonprofit set up, right? So I'm gonna go apply to their nonprofit that they've set up because they may have some funding that can help me do the activities that I want to do. You know, part of that is you probably need to shop there, you know, to get the information, apply that way, or even also reach out to the employees of that business, Petco, for instance. Hey, we got this volunteer opportunity, right? And then you got that business involved. Now you got this shared partnership of volunteers from that business that's aligning with your nonprofit's vision and mission. And then there may be an opportunity for not only volunteer resources, but also material resources, and also maybe even some dollars that can be spent.
Yeah, it really helps it to like get the community involved.
Yes.
And like you said, with the if you need volunteers at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, the students tell me this all the time when I'm like, oh, this nonprofit's looking for volunteers. They have a thing that the students can go on and like a page, you know, they get on and they sign up for the things they want to do because some of them have a certain number of volunteer hours or something that they have to get. So, what are key programs or initiatives that your nonprofit has undertaken and how did you decide on your organization's focus areas?
That's such a great question because let me tell you something, at the very beginning, we probably did like 100 things.
Really?
And I was told, dang, y'all do a lot.
Yeah.
Too much. My board told me. He's like, he do too much. But I was like, oh, this, I mean, so from 2007 to up till COVID, so 2019, 2020, we served three different areas. Mm-hmm. All right. So Oakwood Trailer Park, it's a trailer park that's about 200 trailers in it, so about 800 people. Another trailer park we served, Brookside Trailer Park. At that time, it closed in 2019, but we had a community center there, and it was about 130 trailers. And then we served another neighborhood, a third one. It was a street of duplexes. It was about 300 people that lived there. So we had three different areas. The demographics were all different. Oakwood is pretty representative of Conway. Brookside was primarily immigrants from Guatemala, Nicaragua, and then South Ash is primarily Latino and African American, right? So three different areas, right? So in terms of programming, we was doing all types of stuff. Like obviously we did education, we did cookouts, we did house cleanings, we did house move-ins, we did blah, 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 blah. I just threw stuff up on the wall and see what would stick, right? Over time, though, I had to go through a process of, one, what is it that the neighborhood needs? So having those community meetings and asking them, so we've got all this stuff going on. What is it that you really want? And what is some of the stuff we can just push to the side, or somebody else is doing it and we can connect with them. And if they've been doing it longer and better, then they can handle that. If there's some gap that is existing, but it's something that you see that could be created, then let's focus on that, all right? And so one, my encouragement to everybody is, I would tell my younger self, before you do anything, go knock on every door and ask them what it is that the need is. And let the community members shape what the organization is gonna look like. And over time, that's what we did. So for instance, our gardening program, and I always like to talk about Brian King, and I always tell his story. He would ride a motorcycle, he had a chihuahua, and he was always drinking. And he came to me one day and he was like, "Hey, you think we should have a garden?" And I was like, "I think that's a great idea, right?" And then he left, and then some individuals from St. Joseph Catholic Church showed up at our office a couple of weeks later, and they're like, "Hey, do you know Brian King?" I was like, "Yeah." He was like, "Yeah, he said you're gonna put a garden here." And I said, "Well," he asked, "would it be a good place?" Right? He was like, "Well," he came, his sister goes to St. Joe's, and we're gonna provide all the resources and stuff to get the garden started, right? And I said, "Okay." And Brian came by, and he was like, "So did they come by?" And I said, "Yeah, Brian, they did. Thanks for telling me," right? And they brought all the materials, and people from the community came, and they got it built, and that was our first six boxes, six raised beds, you know? Brian passed away, he had a heart attack in 2018, right? And I've always committed to tell, like, that garden, that large one, which then spread out to three different communities, and then the large one that's near the high school now, that was his idea, somebody from the community. Another one is the playgrounds that we're building. We built one, we're building some more. Those are ideas from two single moms in the community. So the things that we're seeing now, I have to tell people, like, it's everybody coming to the table. And in our regard and what we do, it's the ideas generated by the individuals who are being served. So the question you should ask yourself is, whatever your nonprofit is doing, and since it's more than likely directed at an individual or a group, with the exception of animals, right? Because you can't get feedback from them, right? Ask them, what is it that you need? Before you apply for something, before you go out and get the volunteers for something, ask those individuals, what is it that you need? And then the second question is this: you stated what you need, what is it that you can bring to the table? You brought the idea. Is there anything else you can bring to the table, right? Maybe it's just physical labor. Maybe it's just, oh, I can make copies, or I know how to record things, right? But they're bringing something to the table. You're bringing something to the table as well. I know such and such who has access to those materials. I'm gonna talk to him, her, or them, and then we're gonna get that donation. So you've got the person you're serving, bringing something to the table. You're bringing something to the table. You've got a community partner that's bringing something to the table. That way, everybody, when they sit around, it can be a, we did this type thing together. But everybody's had some part and play in it. So one, asking those that you are serving or serving with, what is the need? Second, what is it that you can bring to the table? Third, now you get into what's going to be the best way to plan and prepare and execute this. And then as you're executing it, evaluate it. Because you're going to have some things that's going to go right, some things that's going to need some adjustment, and some things you're going to be like, "I don't think we should do that." Right? But that feedback, again, comes from who? The people that you're serving, or serving with, your community partners, yourself, you got volunteers. That way, it can be, over the long term, an effective program. And at some point, you may look up and say, "Hey, we don't need this program anymore. right? And that becomes the hard one. Because you've got history tied to this. You've had individuals who put blood, sweat, and tears into this. But if now individuals are thriving and flourishing, whereas they don't need that program anymore, right? Then have the courage and the humility to celebrate the end of it. Because you don't, you know, it's often been said, oh, because we've always done it. Well, that's dangerous, right? Because some things just need to go away, or some other organization has risen up for whatever reason, and they have even more resources to do it even better. You know, so either do we partner, or do we, you know, let it go to the wayside? I don't know. That's a organizational decision that has to happen. But through that evaluation period, but then that opens the opportunity. When one thing closes, something else beautiful can occur. And you just do that whole process over again.
So that kind of brings up another thing, that you can have a nonprofit that has members and one that does not have members. You guys probably don't have members.
No.
So they don't have members, so they're going to the community because that's who they serve, and they're saying, you know, what would you like to see? And other nonprofits, you have members. Like, so one of my clients is the Humane Society of the Ozarks in Northwest Arkansas. And so they're helping the dogs. And the dogs can't tell them, so the people have to decide. But they have members. So you join, and this is a way of the way they get money to help these dogs. And they have a never-ending problem because they're always, you know, actually they're taking cats now too. But the animals are, they're never-ending animals that need help. But so they have members, so their members pay an annual dues or whatever, and so they're getting some money that way. They'll have, you know, events, bring your dog. They have something coming up soon, I think it's in April, called Dog Days or something, and they have it the Sassafras Winery in Springdale, and you bring your dog, and you know, you buy some wine, and the winery gives some money to them, and your dog has all these things. They have foster people, you know, foster parents that take the dogs home and everything. So you can have members, and those members will tell you, here's what we think we should do, or the board of directors decides and takes it to the members. Or if you don't have members, then you're serving some other kind of community, like you're talking about, and then you need to find out, you know, what is it that you guys need, which is in every organization crucial. Because instead of you sitting there saying, you need this, you know, you need to be talking to the people you're serving and finding out what is it that you need and how can I come and help you with that.
Yeah.
But yeah, and that's one of the things that you have to decide in setting up your nonprofit is, will we have members or will we not have members? And a lot of that goes to what kind of nonprofit you're setting up. Because I guess the Humane Society could, you know, do it without members, raise money and whatever, but some organizations lend themselves better to, people want to join, I want to be a part of this, you know, as a member and contribute to it that way. Our next question is, nonprofit work often involves long-term commitment. Can you share any insight or tips for sustaining passion and momentum over time?
Remind yourself of why you got into it. And take moments to, reflect on, if you will, your successes, but also take time to reflect on those learning opportunities that you had, AKA failures, right? I like to say that failure is actually my best friend because that gives me the opportunity, one, to remain humble, but two, to remember that I don't know it all, can't do it all, and have to lean on these other, in my situation, my staff, in my board and these committees, and most importantly, the people that we serve, that we can't be where we're at and continue to go where we're headed without all of these other individuals. So it's taking those moments to do some personal reflection, especially if you're in a position like as the founder, and that's how I'm coming from. Obviously, if you're going into a nonprofit that's already existing, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of those that have come before you, the work that's come before. And so one is understanding that history, but then two, asking yourself, how do I fit into this to continue this legacy moving forward? Because now I'm becoming a steward over other people's work. And that's what I remind my staff of every year. You stand on the shoulders of previous staff members. Right? You know, we have a lot of interns and we have turnover on that end. So reminding them of that as well. You're being handed something for a limited period of time. Take care of this because somebody worked hard at this and we want you to pass it on to the next person because that becomes your work. And I want them to take care of what you did to pass it on to the next person. And that way everybody understands they're woven into something. Beautiful. So, South African principle called Ubuntu. I can't be who I'm supposed to be if you can't be who you're supposed to be, right? And so, when that stuff is woven together, it makes it strong. It makes that organization strong to continue to move forward. So that sustainability, and from my perspective, sustainability for me falls in terms of funding, and it falls in terms of efficiency and effectiveness of the program, because I want those to continue on, right? So from a funding standpoint, it is, you know, endowments and things like that, having those set up so that the work can be funded to continue. But then also on the programming side, can we be better? You know, can we be better in the sense of, are we humanizing people? That question comes out of the vision for the organization, and then the mission. Dignity, this main question comes, they're all connected. So for me, that in terms of programming, is this a sustainable program? Are we remaining true to the mission to get us to what we see life could be like in the future? And so it's going through that process individually for yourself, but then also taking your organization through that process, I would at least at a minimum annually, right? You want to do it more often, fine, but then there's different ways to do that even throughout the year. I sit down with my staff through their evaluations. It's woven through there. During our 6-month period, when we look back at how the first 6 months have gone, we look at that. It's a continual thing of continue the organization to move forward. Whereas for myself, and if you start a nonprofit, I think you're looking at the forest. You have staff that are looking at the trees and the bushes. My mind is always on the forest. And sometimes, and I'll come down, like, hey, where are we at in these trees, right? They're like, oh, okay, we're heading the right direction. Or like, oh, you're going off a little this way, I need to bring you back a little this way, right? Because I see the forest. And there's times I'll just take the staff up. Let's go up to the forest so you can see what the big picture is. And then go back down again and do your thing. And so I think doing it again for yourself and then expanding that out throughout your organization creates cohesion, but then it also has the blood, if you will, that's necessary for the sustainability of the organization.
So you mentioned funding, which is, you know, on the minds of everyone, raising money. And in the situation where, like the Humane Society, you know, they do get grants, but they also do fundraisers, and they rely on dues from their members and their members coming and you know, participating in their fundraisers and all of this. But in an organization like you have, where you don't have members, do you guys have fundraisers, or
yes,
where do you get money? Do you apply for grants?
Yes. So Mrs. Snar taught me to look at funding like Thanksgiving plate. He was like, "Do you want all turkey?" I was like, "No." He's like, "Do you want all sweet potatoes?" I said, said, well, mama making, you know, you want, you know, a little bit of turkey, a little bit of dressing, sweet potatoes, you know, the like, right? You want a little bit of everything. Funding is the same way. I want public, I want private in terms of grants. In terms of donations, I want monthly. You'll have those one time a year big gift types. I want funding from small businesses, churches, and the like. I want a good plate, mainly because funding is not forever. Now, in terms of like grants, public grants, you may get, you know, you could have a yearly, 2-3 year type, right? But that's like reimbursable, typically. So that means you spend the money and then you get the money back, right? It's not upfront. Like if I applied to Walmart, or we got a grant from Simmons First Foundation, they gave us a $50,000 check upfront, right? For work we're doing versus funding we got for Hope Village. We got some funding, but it was reimbursable. So I have to have construction spend it, I have to send receipts and all that kind of stuff, and then the money comes back, right? So you have to look at, one, having a variety of funding sources, all right, and types, and then what you're capable of receiving and managing, okay? So that requires, you know, you talked about like a 3 years worth of receipts and all that kind of stuff, history. You know, there's going to be some potential donors who are going to ask for that type of information as well, because they're going to want to know, do you have the capacity to spend this amount of money? And that's typically when you get into the six-figure type request. They want to know, do you have the capacity, do you have the policies and procedures in place? Have you demonstrated up to this point the capacity to essentially manage this amount of money, right? Because eventually somebody's gonna come back around and wanna audit that. And you wanna be in a position to where the next person you go apply for, it's just a no-brainer, right? So the other thing I say is not all money is good money, right? So there's some, when you're applying as well, or whoever it is, it could be a private donor, you need to sit down and have that discussion with them. How do you want this money to be used? Is it general? Is it designated? Right? What expectations do you have as an organization? You got to ask those questions, because some may be like, well, I want you to do these things and do these things, right? Now, there's some legal things I can't do, right? But then also, if it's not in line with my vision and mission of my organization, can you as a leader say, thank you, I'm going to walk away from this one? And what's a fundraise another way, right? Fundraising events. There are different events to secure a certain amount of money, right? So if your goal is, we're going to raise $5,000, we're going to put on a car wash. Is a car wash the appropriate vehicle to raise $5,000? I mean, I don't know. Depends on where you are. I don't know, right? Now, if I put on a wine thing, could we possibly raise like $5,000-$10,000? Right? Okay, that's possible, right? Now, let's go get all the sponsorships first, right? That's going to cover all that so we can walk away with $5,000-$10,000, right? So it's also important to get people around you who love to raise money, and who have no issue talking about raising money, or going to sit down and be like, so, you seen all this, right? So are you ready to write that check, right? What is it that you need? You want your name on the wall, you need a building, what you want, right? Because there are people like that, but then there are also people that I have, right, who don't ever want to be mentioned. And they have their reasons why they don't want to be mentioned, right? So you have to have those discussions with those individuals as well, and be clear how that money is going to be spent, what it's going to be spent on, and then be a good steward of it. Yeah, because people want to know that their money is going toward something good and it's being used, and they can see it, you know, and There's going to be people that want the acknowledgement. There's going to be some that don't. And that's okay. But it's a good relationship to have.
So it's probably obvious to you guys that you really need a team.
Yes.
You know, you can do some things yourself, especially from the beginning. But I don't know. I'm not counting the volunteers that are helping you put these things on. You know, we probably mentioned 5 or 6 people that you really need. You need kind of like a marketing person or somebody who doesn't mind asking for money. I work with a lot of, personally am involved with a lot of nonprofits. One of them, I run a race. I'm a runner. And so we do a race in Northwest Arkansas. And I have to go and ask for sponsors. And I get other people that say, oh, I'll help you with that. Oh, I don't like to ask for money. Okay, you go over here and do this job because you have to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like, can you give me money to go buy a cup of coffee?
Yeah.
You know, it's for a good cause, but you need a lot of people. And when you file your 990 that we talked about with the IRS earlier, those are publicly available. So you're gonna tell the public, if anyone in the public that wants to know, who's giving you money. So when you go to get money, you don't necessarily want to ask the mafia or, you know, somebody who you don't want to have to publicly say, gave me this money. And I know for a fact that nonprofits look at those things for other nonprofits, because some of the ones my clients, they'll say, oh, well, so-and-so gets their money from here, you know. So that's another thing about raising money that you want to keep in mind is, not, you know, can I take this money? Can I give you what you want? And do I want to be associated with these people? Okay, so can you recall a specific moment or project that made you realize the impact that your nonprofit was having? And how did that moment inspire you to keep going?
I mentioned the Brookside Trailer Park community. So we had been there. The landlord had asked us to come over in 2012, and so for 7 years we were there, education going, different types of community events. We had an English as a second language that the community had asked for, so we had that happening during the night, like dinners, birthday parties, all that kind of stuff. And then the landlord called me March of 2019. He said, I'm closing the trailer park down. And I said, whoa. And he said he's sending out the notice April 15th, 2019. And I remember that to this day. And they have 60 days to move. And this was 130 households. Again, primarily immigrants. English was very limited for a lot of them. A lot of kids that we served there. And I remember him passing out the notice to everybody, and like, you know, phone calls, our office getting overwhelmed and all that, because we were like family there. And we had a community meeting at our community center the following week, and it was just packed, like inside, outside. Like state senators showed up, the mayor showed up, all types of people showed up. And I just remember letting them know, the translator to the side, that nobody was going to go homeless. People would have a place to stay. And so from there, it was a long process of understanding each household's needs. Yeah, some households that were saving money to buy some land, some that had land and just needed to move their trailer. You had others who were renting to own their trailer from the landlord. You had others who was just renting. And so you had all these different types of scenarios. The other scenario you had is, this was in the middle of the school year. And you got elementary to high school. We got one high school in Conway, so to move anywhere was one thing for the high schoolers, but for the elementary that are zoned in a particular area, now it's working with the school district. Like, even if this kid has to move out of their school, they've got to move out of this area and they've got to move into another zone, can they still go to the school that they're in? Because now you're asking that family and that student specifically to make a radical transition with 2 to 3 months left in school. And, you know, it was like in the news and all that, and eventually Secretary of State got involved because, excuse me, the Attorney General got involved because some of the contracts were not legal, and he was doing things on the contracts and the tenants didn't know about it. And so which turned into a lawsuit, and then us going to court, me going to court and testifying against him, and then him ultimately saying, I don't want you to, and I quote, you get the hell off my property. Now this is the, it started off great, you know, it ended poorly, but most importantly was, you know, every almost week that we met, it was ended in some type of crime. It was an emotional year for that. Every family that I still see today, and most of those kids are older now. I see Sue Lady, she's grown up now, and she works at Chick-fil-A. She's going to UCA to study nursing. There was Sergio, who grew up and became one of my staff members. Those are kids and the adults that, like we see now, and I see they still come to the office or see them around Conway, like we're still like family, you know? And that was probably the hugest event. And I had to put our Hope Village project on hold because of that, because that was more important. I can't be building houses while people are losing their houses. So we did that, and all that was happening. And so I would say, don't take for granted the impact that you can have on somebody's life. And you're working specifically with people. Remember, those are people. They're not numbers, statistics, numbers to put on some grant application or something like that. These are real life people with stories and lives and situations. And you are there not to do something for them, but to walk with them through their particular experience, so that not only are they changed, but I make the argument you're changed as well.
So we're about out of time, and we've given you a lot of tips and advice on if you're forming a nonprofit, but let's give the audience a chance to ask any questions that you guys might have. Anybody have any questions?
Okay, so you talked about taxes. So with personal taxes, I assume it's the same as like business taxes. So you have to bring in a certain amount before you're required to file, right? Or is that not?
So what the IRS does is they have like a scale. So you have to make a filing. It's a very simple filing, but you have to make a filing if you make, thank you, if you make less, if you make this amount of money, and then if you make more, you may do a more complicated filing. So you have to make that filing, and that's what we were talking about. If you don't do that for 3 consecutive years, they'll automatically revoke your exempt status. And that gets a lot of people into trouble because they think, oh, I haven't made enough money. I haven't brought in enough money to make that filing. But it is a requirement, even if you've brought in zero, spent zero, as long as you have this nonprofit that's still going. Does that help?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Anybody else?
Can you all kind of do a really in-depth kind of breakdown and like overview of kind of like our nonprofit? If we have like a question that pops up later, because I just graduated last semester, so this is like one of the areas that I do want to go into. How can we kind of reach
how can you reach us?
Yes.
Is that the question?
Yes.
I can give you my card.
Yeah, I can give you mine.
If you want, any of you who are interested, you know, and you can contact me. Yeah, and that goes back to something that I was thinking about. So, you know, I had said that I am on the board of some of my clients' nonprofits as their attorney. And we were talking about and get yourself an accountant. And another thing that would be really good for everybody starting a business or profit, for-profit or nonprofit, is a mentor. Mm-hmm. Someone who's been through your struggles and knows the, you know, the day-to-day kind of things, or that can tell you. I mean, I wouldn't charge somebody money to tell them that, yeah, you got to file your 990, you know, but somebody that you don't mind asking and say, hey, you know, I didn't do this last year, or how do I do it, or whatever. So it's always a good idea to have a mentor. And if you look at bigger companies, for-profit companies that have a board of directors, they don't just pull them nilly-willy out of the air. These people have expertise, you know, and they're bringing something to the table that's going to help this company thrive and flourish. So getting a mentor is a good idea. But yeah, I'm happy to give my business cards I can give you guys. You're welcome to contact us. Do you have any last minute? Does anybody else have any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Would you recommend any grant writing programs or?
Yeah, so where are you at? Located?
I'm in Jonesboro.
Jonesboro? I would get with ASU, okay? And getting either in their English department or maybe business, and see if they've got a class that's offered technical writing or grant writing. And typically, those students are assigned a project to write a grant. So they're going through the course already, and they can partner with a nonprofit, right? And they're gonna write that grant for you. So they're getting what they need, class credit. You're getting something as well, a grant that can be submitted. So we work with, UCA's got it, also Euler has it as well. And we've gotten grant writers every year, and that's where our interns come from. And they produce one grant, you know, for the semester or whatever. But I would start there before considering paying somebody an exorbitant amount of money. Grant writers. Grant writers ain't cheap, I'll be honest with you. So we can start with students, especially those who like to write and can write, they can go a long way. My best grant writer, Emily Giss, she was from UCA, and she works at the Dem Gazette now. She was a fabulous writer. And so you never know who you're gonna get. So that's where I would start. Start with your local college and what they offer. And again, meet with that department, professor, let them know about your nonprofit and what you're looking for.
What about sourcing those grants? Like, is there a website that you can look to, or is there,
you could, there's numerous ways. So one is, there's one called Grant Station. You got to pay for it every year. Another way is, she kind of hit on it. You can go look at other nonprofits, 990s, and see who they gave money for. Then you just got to do the hustle and research, and then read what their requirements are. If it's a private individual, obviously that's probably built off of a personal relationship or something. But if it's like a foundation or something like that, then you just Google that foundation and see what it is they're offering. Some foundations don't like solicitations. Others ask for an LOI, a letter of interest, and you send them and they'll look at whether or not you fit their criteria and the like. But then there's other ones where it's just, they have particular deadlines for LOI, when the application needs to be submitted, and when the determination is. Those are ways that you found. And then once you get that relationship, I create a spreadsheet of all those individuals, and I just cycle back through them. Because some you can get awarded once, you can't apply again next year. Some you can apply, you gotta wait a cooling off period before you can. Others you can do it every year. So you just gotta come up with a plan in how to tackle that.
Anybody else have any questions or another question, or we're here?
I have so many questions. I'm just curious. What's a good way to keep in touch with you if they have more questions or people want more information?
My website's philipfletcher.org, Philip with two L's. And then you can connect with me that way. And I love talking about this stuff. So
I don't know if he's open as a mentor, but I think he'd be a good one.
Yeah, I'll ask him.
Or maybe he can suggest someone.
Yeah. I have a thing called Replicate that helps people start nonprofits. I shoot them to a lawyer because I'm not a lawyer. But all that, all the other stuff, like the what's your vision, mission, and all that. And my PhD is in organizational leadership, specifically in nonprofit development. So I focus more on the all of that infrastructure and all that, and the leader, the founder, and all that leadership development. If it's a lawyer, accountant stuff, I'd be like, you need to find somebody, you know? But it's all built off of what Mark Snar did for me. He met with me 6:30 every morning on a Friday. We had breakfast and he just poured that into me. And I think when people have that, it sets them up for more success. Mentorship is important. And having somebody to walk with you through that, or you know, call them and, hey, what you think of this? And then be able to tell you, yeah, don't do that. One of the first things I tell people is, don't even talk to me about you wanting a building. Buildings are headaches. They're beautiful. They get things done. But everything associated, I mean, who owns a house or an apartment? Now think about, that's something else you gotta manage. Insurance again, right? Liability and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, utility bills and all that. I'm like, can you tell me what it is that you wanna do and how you see the world differently? Well, I don't know. Well, let's not talk about a building. You know, I've put myself in that role because I want to see someone be successful and not get so overwhelmed if just like they just walk away because it's too much. It's a lot. A friend of mine had told me when I first got started, she was like, Philip, in some ways a nonprofit is no different than my construction business. It has similar things. You gotta have revenue, donation. You gotta have expenses, you gotta have a budget, right? You gotta take care of employees, right? You gotta be able to deal with all the things that come with employees, right? I mean, just because it's a nonprofit, you do great things doesn't mean difficult things don't happen within the organization that you gotta deal with, right? You gotta have marketing and all that kind of stuff. And you gotta be able to juggle that stuff, but then also have people around you who do it better, you know? And you just gotta leverage everything in front of you and be creative about it. But at the end of the day, having somebody come around you that can help guide you and then step back. Be like, all right, have fun, go ahead. Hit me up when you need something else. That goes a long way, so.
Well, I guess that's it. If you guys don't have any other questions, you've been a great audience. I appreciate everybody's attentiveness. I teach sometimes at the University of Arkansas at the law school, and
hey, if you found something of value, subscribe to the YouTube channel. Find us on Facebook at Dr. Philip Fletcher. Find us on Twitter at Phil Fletcher. And as always, visit us on the website philipfletcher.org.